Good evening. A $2 trillion stimulus in the works, but will the GOP support their president? Bolivia's left wins in a landslide, and the future of the Lucerne Hotel and of homeless people citywide. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI News for Tuesday, October 20th, 2020. And in out of this world news, the OSIRIS-REx spacecraft, 200 million miles away and orbiting an Empire State Building-sized pile of rubble, began its descent to scoop up a few kilograms of the precious dirt for return to planet Earth. The spacecraft dropped out of orbit on Tuesday, right on time, beginning a 4.5-hour descent to the boulder-strewn face of the ancient asteroid Bennu, named after the soul of the Egyptian sun god and progenitor of the modern-day phoenix. Osiris, itself named after the Egyptian god of the dead, will hover just above the surface of the space rock, reaching out with an 11-foot arm, dodging boulders as it kisses the asteroid and grabs a handful of dirt. The $800 million quest will end with OSIRIS's return to Earth in 2023. Japan's space agency has already grabbed small samples of an asteroid for return to Earth. The orbiting rock piles, usually found between Mars and Jupiter, are expected to provide answers to questions about the beginnings of the solar system 4.5 billion years ago. And meanwhile, firmly planted on planet Earth, the Justice Department has sued Google for antitrust violations. The government alleges the internet giant abused its dominance in online search and advertising to stifle competition and harm consumers. The move could be an opening salvo of a wider legal war, with ongoing investigations of Apple, Amazon, and Facebook at both the DOJ and Federal Trade Commission. Google is owned by Alphabet Incorporated, a trillion-dollar company long accused by consumer advocates of abusing its internet dominance. Google responded in a tweet that the lawsuit is deeply flawed because the company says users can't find alternatives. The Trump administration has long had Google in its sights. Trump has often criticized Google, recycling unfounded claims by conservatives their views are being suppressed, and accusing the search engine of being too chummy with China. And President Donald Trump shunned formal debate practice Tuesday and was heading instead for another of his big rallies 2 days ahead of the final presidential debate. Thursday's face-off is in Nashville, and Trump is trailing in most battleground states as he works to pull off a repeat of his come-from-behind victory of 2016. The Commission on Presidential Debates unveiled a rules change meant to reduce Trump's interruptions of Biden that marred the first debate and led to angry exchanges. This time, Trump and Biden will each have his microphone cut off while his rival delivers an opening 2-minute answer to each of the 6 debate topics. The mute button won't figure in the open portion of the debate. And Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said Tuesday that he'll schedule a vote if House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and the Trump administration are able to seal an agreement on a huge COVID-19 relief bill.
If a presidentially supported bill clears the House, at some point we'll bring it to the floor, yes. We'd have to see what it was first. There's been no deal announced. If a deal is announced, then it'll have to be written. Then people will have a chance to take a look at it. Then it'll have to clear the House. And if all of that occurs, of course, we would consider it in the Senate. If such a deal were to clear the House, obviously with a presidential signature promised, we would put it on the floor of the Senate and let the Senate consider it.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. His remarks came as Pelosi and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin have reportedly arrived at a critical phase of their talks. The $2 trillion package apparently being supported by Trump has GOP fiscal conservatives reeling, as some Republicans have been distancing themselves from a presidency, expressing hallmark traits of a political train wreck. Meanwhile, Bolivia's president-elect Luis Arce says there will be no role in his government for Socialist Party leader Evo Morales, who governed for almost 14 years before resigning under pressure last year. Morales is in exile in Argentina, where he remains the president of Arce's party, the Movement Towards Socialism, or MAS. Morales has lived outside Bolivia since he fled last year following a vote that was attacked as fraudulent by election observers led by the Organization of American States and influenced by its United States delegate Carlos Trujillo. The fraud allegations, based on the OAS's attack on ballots from remote indigenous areas that were counted late, were discredited in a report recently released by the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. Jake Johnston co-authored the 82-page report.
The lie that they initially made was clear to anyone who had looked at the data. So I think it's the OAS is portraying themselves as electoral experts. It's hard to imagine that they could have said this knowing it was not true, right? And I think, you know, what we've seen since is some reporting, including from the Los Angeles Times, indicating that the U.S. representative to the OAS, Carlos Trujillo, in fact, had pressured the OAS observer mission to reach a determination of fraud in that election.
There's so many similar things happening in the United States today with the whole concept of election fraud. How does this fit into Bolivia's history, as far as you know it, and link it to what's happening in the United States?
There's a real danger in biased electoral monitoring and people reaching conclusions without presenting full data about what they actually found. The reason why we were so skeptical of the OAS claims from the get-go is that this isn't something new for the OAS. In fact, in 2010, the OAS conducted an audit around the Haiti election and recommended overturning the results of the election without actually performing a recount or anything like that and actually changing who was in the top two positions. So again, this is something that we've seen before in the politicization of these electoral observation missions and of the lack of neutrality in the OAS. One thing I think that does relate to the current situation in the U.S. is this idea of sort of seizing on early results and then as things change, saying that's proof of fraud. So I think there's an expectation in the U.S. that because of the amount of mail-in voting, it's going to take a while to actually get a reflective and accurate count of the vote. And I think it's really clear, and this was extremely important and was not followed in Bolivia, is waiting for those results to actually be counted before making proclamations over what those results may be.
The interim government, which was bitterly opposed to Evo Morales, has accepted the fact, even based on preliminary results and early results, that they've lost. What changed?
The main thing that changed is the margins here. So the big question in the 2019 election was if Evo Morales was going to receive a large enough margin to win in the first round.
Anything you'd like to add?
We saw this past weekend a repudiation of last year's coup. One key thing looking forward about the role of the OAS as an electoral observation mission and as its role in the hemisphere. And I think it's absolutely critical now that there is accountability for OAS actions in Bolivia.
Jake Johnston co-authored the 82-page report by the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. Professor Thomas C. Field is an election observer with the group Academics for Democracy in Latin America. He says the MAS victory was overwhelming, making it impossible for the right-wing interim government to claim fraud.
There was a lot of suspicion and tension on the left, but ends up it was just the Electoral Commission was just being extra careful. And it was an overwhelming victory for the MAS party. The MAS party, according to the exit polls, won by 22%. So that's why you saw the interim president already congratulate the MAS party. You even saw the OAS general secretary, the Organization of American States General Secretary Luis Almagro, who was actually one of the leading boosters of the coup to overthrow Evo Morales last year, pushing the sort of fraud narrative either out of incompetence or malice. The OAS had sort of participated in the coup. The United States government, the Trump administration, applauded the coup itself, calling it victory for democracy. So a lot of those who supported the coup, thinking that the last election was fraudulent, I think now they have a lot to answer for, because now we see that an election run by USAID and these interim governments and these electoral officials who were anything but MAS party members, I mean, they were quite the opposite. They were involved in the entire process of the overthrow, and they just ran an election that I think was free and fair, because why would they have cheated for the MAS party? It's an overwhelming repudiation of the coup, emotional restoration of democracy for Bolivia. A lot of people are relieved. A lot of political prisoners who have been falsely accused of trumped up charges of terrorism and sedition. All the ministers of the MAS party are now can come back home, presuming nothing happens between now and Inauguration Day. The far right has organized paramilitaries, hit squads, shock troops. The victory was so overwhelming that the hope is that they can go in the streets, but no one's going to follow them out there.
What could the United States learn from this?
The interim government in Bolivia has congratulated the victors because they know they're going to lose and they're not trying to stop the count. In many ways, the interim government, as repressive as they have, as much blood as they have on their hands in terms of two massacres of dozens of indigenous peasants in November 2019, they still believe that the vote should be counted. I mean, I think we're under even more threat here in the United States because we have a president who's already claiming that he's not going to wait for the later votes. So the official votes in Bolivia, they've only counted 35% so far, and they're doing it all by hand. They're not going to have it all counted for 3 days. but the interim government has respected the fact that the exit polls show what's already coming out through the count. If they had acted like the Trump campaign is claiming that they're going to act, then Bolivia would be in another electoral crisis. I don't know what's going to happen here. If the Trump administration tries to stop the counting of late votes, like they did in Florida, like they did in Arizona with the Senate and governor races a couple years ago, we're in for trouble. This idea that you don't count the late votes, it was an affront to democracy then. They learned, and they are waiting for all the votes to be counted this time because egg is on their face, but there's blood on the streets. The coup took place because they wouldn't wait to count the late votes. And if we don't do that here, yeah, we're going to have a similar problem. If the Trump campaign won't wait for all the votes to be counted before trying to declare victory or something, yeah, we're in for trouble.
Professor Thomas E. Field is an election observer with the group Academics for Democracy in Latin America. As finance minister under Morales, Arce helped preside over an economy that was growing faster than almost any in the region. But when he assumes Bolivia's presidency next month, he'll be taking over a country facing a crippling recession. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. And WBAI went along with Manhattan City Council candidate Monday, who walked through Midtown Manhattan handing out free masks her campaign purchased to distribute to homeless people. The homeless people are now residents of hotels in Midtown being used to house residents removed from the city's congregate shelter system in the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic. The city has been housing homeless people in hotels made empty by the dearth of tourists visiting the city. Community activist Marnie Halassa says she heard from homeless people in her neighborhood that face masks were unavailable to hotel residents.
I am a community activist in District 3. We're on the corner of 36th and 9th Avenue. This is a street where you have a lot of the hotels where the homeless were moved in by my mayor, de Blasio. I've heard from them that they need masks, that they were moved into the hotel, which is actually, they like that because they actually have a home. But at the same time, they don't have any masks. So my campaign bought some masks. We've been also asking people to donate masks to the campaign so we can go out. People are taking the masks. They're like, thank you. No, not one person has said no to the masks. So that's.
Halassa says she tried to get a response from the city before moving to help on her own.
We called 311. Campaign contacted Jemani Williams' office, also Gail Brewer's office. And it seems very difficult to get masks, and we don't know why that is. But I've also kind of heard that the city is saying that all these masks are available, but then people can't get them. And that's very classic New York City. This is the, I think it's the Times Square Hotel. And there's a variety, then also the Stay Pineapple Hotel. And there's a variety of hotels that are housing the homeless on 35th Street, also 36th and also 37th Street. So we're going to go over there too.
And that's District 3 City Council candidate Marnie Halassa handing out masks to homeless hotel residents in Midtown on Monday. One of the residents of the Times Square Hotel on 36th Street is Keith Mann. He says he's happy to have a room, but there are some problems.
From Chima, we came here for the mayor. And after that, we've not been in after that. You know, we've been here. Check it out, own place. Some guys want to play games. Some guys want to be in the streets. This is better for us. We in a hotel. From here, you go to your own place from here. If you want to make it, guys come to play a game. I'm handicapped. I got riders. I'm trying to get out of here the best I could.
What's the problems in there?
No problems.
What's the good thing about it?
You got a place to stay.
Do you have your own room?
Yeah, I got my own room. Or you share with somebody. Share with somebody is no good. A lot of problems. Fighting, stealing, aggravation. I'm a place. I lost it in December of last year. So that's why I'm in the shelter now. I have my mother place and I lost it in December of last year. I lost it, so I came here on my own. I take care of myself. I'll be 59 next month. So we get older, we got to take care of ourselves. I don't wear a mask, but I'm by myself. Sometimes hard to breathe. But by myself, I take it all. People come around me, I put it on. Like you, you know what I'm saying? You know, you can be good, but that don't mean nothing at all. People like this to hang out to every block. We need this. But it's coming back. When it come back, it'll be a problem. I'm saying this is, it's gonna get worse next year. Keith Mann. God bless you.
That's all I know.
Another group of residents sitting in front of a well-manicured 37th Street hotel discussed some of the problems of being homeless in New York while praising their current rooms.
I'm not going to knock. It's wonderful. I went in. But it's all about the process.
I went in.
Everything that they're doing is slow motion.
So, yeah.
We need help.
It's not the counselors in that. It's DHS. The men officers, they try to hurt you in here.
It's like the thought and sprinkle of every department that needs to be.
They transferring them.
Yeah, after I talked to Ms. Sanchez.
The way they manhandle.
Yeah.
They manhandle
you, put the handcuffs on you real tight. They be really trying to hurt them. Women in here.
When they have a reason?
I noticed they have tasers.
Yeah,
they never tase us.
Yeah, I don't give them a chance to put their hands on me.
In New Providence, they used to tase the ladies that used to come in intoxicated and they didn't want them to check them, you know, like search them. There was this girl named Kiki that she went into a cardiac arrest after they tased her because they tased her so much.
Yo, Jersey.
Hey, bro.
I was there when it happened.
It looked like news.
We in October, in June.
In this place here?
No, in 46th Street, New Providence. She came intoxicated. She didn't want them to search her or a pocket or something. I really don't know the story because, you know, it's different stories. But, yeah, that was what was said, that they tased her, and when the ambulance came, she went into a cardiac arrest. They had to pump her. She got money behind that. She's suing them.
Some homeless folks now house in vacant hotels in Midtown Manhattan. But as some homeless people were happily housed for the night, at least for the time being, 285 men, residents of the Lucerne Hotel on 79th Street, are facing what their lawyer says is irreparable damage if the city gets its way and moves them to another hotel, the Radisson, in the financial district known as FIDE. It's the latest twist in the legal battle. Three of the men staying at the hotel had sued to stay and won a temporary restraining order. The move the judge halted was prompted by a citizens group of Upper West Side residents represented by former Giuliani-era deputy mayor Randy Maestro. Chris Brown of the group Downtown New York City for Safe Streets opposed the homeless men being sent to the Radisson, which is in his backyard.
These are children. Within 1 mile, there's 11 schools. Within a half a mile, there's 6 schools. Within 300 feet, there's 3 schools, Bright Horizon Early Learning, Pine Street School, and Quad Prep. Diagonally across the street, there's an open area called Fosen Plaza. This plaza is used daily as a place for kids to go to recess. They had a fire drill at the school the other day. The kids use that plaza. We have families that, you know, let their kids play there on a daily basis. This is right in front of this proposed location.
That's Chris Brown of the group Downtown New York City for Safe Streets. But Corrine Lau, a member of Upper West Side Open Hearts Initiative, has been supportive of making Lucerne into a shelter.
There are children in every neighborhood of this city. Your children are not any different than those that live in different neighborhoods of the city. Everybody has to share responsibility for solving the crisis of homelessness in New York City. Would it be better if Mayor de Blasio had committed to permanent housing at the beginning of his term? Absolutely. But that's not what's happened. And so we have homeless individuals. We have single adult homeless individuals. And some of those single adult homeless individuals are in substance use recovery or current substance users. They are still human beings. They still deserve a safe place to live. And if you say not in my backyard, all that means is that it goes to someone else's backyard. And that's exactly what we're seeing now, because a small group of wealthy residents on the Upper West Side hired a lawyer to say not in my backyard. And so now they're trying to move it to your backyard. But why should it be moved from place to place? You know, these are human beings and we can open our hearts to welcome them.
Corrine Lau is a member of Upper West Side Open Hearts Initiative. The city council person for the Upper West Side district where the Lucerne is located is Helen Rosenthal. She says it's best for all concerned to leave the homeless men where they are for now.
Some men are not handling it well. They're, of course, live in an unstable situation anyway, and the negative attacks on them has really affected them psychologically. The mayor seems confident the city will win. The whole thing is perplexing. It was the judge who added this very thoughtful perspective to our homeless crisis, in contrast to the mayor's very disoriented approach.
The elephant in the room here in the elevator is NIMBY. And it was interesting to hear the CB1 debate of the folks who live near the Radisson and William Street location. I guess that's the Radisson. They are saying, don't send us any homeless down here. And then the people up on the Upper West Side are saying, some of them anyway, you know, and many weren't, send all these people down there. And you have two groups of citizen groups shoving the same group of 250 men back and forth to each other.
It's heartbreaking. If you go back to a couple of weeks ago, it is true that the mere threat of a lawsuit got the mayor to respond to the Upper West Side group and move the men downtown. And that set precedent. As you say, now the Five Die group actually sued. And interestingly, the court ruled against the Five Die group, saying that moving the men to the Radisson would not do irreparable harm to the neighbors. That has superseded the precedent that the mayor set by responding to Randy Mastro's threat of a lawsuit. The mayor should think about whether or not Randy Mastro's threat of a lawsuit matters, because the court seems to be saying it doesn't matter. If sued, the court will not side with the Randy Mastros of the world.
Randy Mastro was deputy mayor Giuliani or something?
He worked under Giuliani. Look, he's got a ton of political connections. Obviously, his connections got him immediately to the mayor, who then has made a decision based on whatever Randy said. And now every group in the city is wanting to hire Randy Mastro.
Eventually, evictions are going to start again, and there's going to be people in the streets more than ever.
Yeah. It's really ironic to those of us who embraced the mayor's 2013 Tale of Two Cities campaign to see how this has played out. One, New York, where high-priced lawyers call the tune and their enablers in government cling stubbornly to decisions that actually few support. And another, New York, where leadership on issues of poverty and inequality come more from the residents struggling against these conditions than from city officials elected to reverse them. With that, it gives me hope about all the residents who rose to the occasion and have worked very hard to keep the men here at the Lucerne, given that there's really no reason for them to move. The Department of Health, by being transparent, they will have many fewer problems with communities. And communities can prepare better to welcome homeless. In this situation, literally in the middle of the night, Sunday to Monday this past week, DHS put two homeless individuals wanting to come in off the street at the Radisson downtown without telling anyone. I don't know if they even have a provider yet to take care of the people who are now at the Radisson. Transparency, sunlight would behoove the city, especially in preparation for, as you say, what could become just a complete crisis of homelessness with people being evicted out of their homes. What happens when COVID is over, the hotels want to get back to their business of tourism, which is right and good, and landlords follow through on their threats of eviction because people haven't paid rent for months. Someone's got to be paying attention to that and thinking very hard, because it's going to be a mess, as you said.
Councilmember Helen Rosenthal represents the Upper West Side. But speaking today, Mayor de Blasio says he's sticking with his plan to end the use of hotels without returning to congregate shelters.
Even though the process of going back to congregate shelter will be a long one, I think on that level, I don't expect to see a lot of changes in terms of going back to congregate shelter anytime soon. But in terms of going, for example, a situation like we're talking about now, getting out of a hotel to get people to an actual shelter with services, I still think that makes sense. In fact, it's the safer option because the services are there, the health care is more available. And we also have to remember, you know, we have to be able to pursue more than one goal at once. And the hotels just are not the ideal option for homeless people. It's not the best way to support them on their path, you know, out of shelter and to affordable housing. So I would not think in terms of a blanket approach. I think we have to put the healthcare considerations front and center, and we have to be particularly careful about anything that might involve going back to a congregate setting. And none of the things that have been talked about in recent weeks have to do with those congregate settings. Those are a whole different topic that we have not addressed so far.
Mayor Bill de Blasio, the next hearing on the TRO is on November 16th. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, October 20th, 2020. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From New York City, I'm Paul DiRienzo for the WBAI News. Thanks for listening.